Okay. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the first class in the module on karma. This is the third module in the Discovering Buddhism series, which is a two-year series made up of 13 modules covering all the basic points of Tibetan Buddhism. I taught the first module back at the end of the year, which was Mind and Its Potential. And Don Brown just finished teaching, Following the Path, Presenting the Path. And so now we're up to Karma. And this is a six-week class, Monday nights, six Monday nights for a total of 5 weeks. And I'd just like to start off with some logistical information. How many people are here at Kadampa Center for the very first time tonight? Anyone? Oh, okay. How many people are taking their first Discovering Buddhism class tonight? Okay. So you missed Mind and Its Potential and Presenting the Path, but I think, you know, I'll go back and do a little bit of review on those, so I don't think that'll be a problem. Is there anyone who's taken this module before on karma? And did I teach it when you took it? That's been, I think that was 2009, wasn't it? It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So, wait, let me see the hands of people who've taken it before. Okay, because y'all are the ones I'm going to pick on really bad. Okay.
Okay.
But some people take it with me, right? Okay. That's great. And who is doing the entire Discovering Buddhism series for credit to officially take the whole course? Okay, so that's good. That's a number of people are doing that. Like I say, we have six Monday nights from 7 to 8:30. I like to start on time and I like to finish on time. A little bit of logistical information. Since everyone's been here before, they know where the bathrooms are. I just want to warn people about the traffic patterns outside, because at night, when you're coming off Hillsborough Street, cars are coming down here quite fast, and it's hard to see where you have to make this left-hand turn. So please put on your left-hand turn signal way in advance, okay? And do not cut to the left of the dividers as soon as you see them. Go down to the left-hand turn, because there will be people coming out on the street making a right-hand turn. So everyone just be very careful as they're driving around. And there will be a discussion group after the classes, an informal discussion group. They'll meet out in the library around the table, and everyone is welcome to attend that. My name's Robbie Watkins, for people who don't know me. I've been coming to Kadampa Center since 1992. I've been studying Tibetan Buddhism since 1980. And I've been teaching classes such as this for almost 20 years. I always get to teach Mind and Its Potential. That's my favorite class. But Karma is my second favorite class, so I get to teach that, hopefully. And I think it's going to be a good class. Couple readings. This CD called Discovering Buddhism has the readings for all 13 modules on it for the low price of $20. So if you're going to do this class or more, buy this. This is a real good deal. The readings for this class, I always tell people, they're not exactly in sync with what I'm teaching in the class. They're more kind of parallel to it, or a little bit of additional information. If you're doing the class for credit, i.e. you want to get an official certificate from the FPMT that you've done the entire Discovering Buddhism series, you have to do these readings. So that's for sale out in the bookstore. There's a freestanding bookshelf when you come in, and just at the beginning of the carpeted area, that has all the Discovering Buddhism materials on it. If you would like to do more reading, I'm recommending a book called The Meaning of Life. This is one by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, translated by Jeffrey Hopkins, who is probably the leading American scholar of Buddhism. And that's for sale in the bookstore also. Highly recommended. This is a great book. If you buy a lot of Buddhist books, be careful. They have this wonderful habit of repackaging things with different titles or different covers, and it looks like a new book, and you already have two other copies of it at home. So if you have an extensive library, you may want to check. But that's a good book, highly recommended. And then another resource I always recommend is called Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. This is also for sale in the bookstore. This is a complete overview of the entire Buddhist path. It was written in the 1930s by one of the great Tibetan lamas. And it outlines the entire path. Some people may think it's a little bit dry, but it's an excellent reference source for going back and getting the basic points of Tibetan Buddhism from. And I always refer back to this when I have any questions or confusion. Classes here at Kadampa Center are done on a donation basis. There's no fee, but certainly we have expenses in opening the center and putting them on, so donations are always appreciated. There are donation boxes around the center, cash or checks made out to Kadampa Center. We're a tax-deductible organization, so anything you can give to help keep the center open is greatly appreciated. There will be homework each class, which is mainly things to think about and discuss with yourself. There's no written homework. The most important part of the homework is going to be establishing a daily meditation practice for the 5 weeks in between the classes. Do we have anyone here who's never done any meditation before? Okay, so everybody's got some experience with meditation. That's good. What does meditation mean? Anybody know what the word meditation means according to the Tibetan Buddhists? To become familiar with. It doesn't mean spacing out or going blank. It means becoming familiar with, and then with different things, different qualities of your own mind, different characteristics that you'd like to develop in your mind, like compassion and wisdom. Just becoming familiar with your own mind and how it works. The Tibetan word for meditation is gom, G-O-M. And that's why we refer to this room as a gompa, a room for meditation. But meditation is simply becoming familiar with, in the Buddhist tradition, a virtuous object. You could meditate on rape and killing and stealing, but that would not be very beneficial from the Buddhist point of view. But it's taking your mind and becoming familiar with. It's nothing more than that. It's simply working with your mind. There are two major types of meditation that we discuss in Tibetan Buddhism. The first is concentration, where we just use and develop our mind's ability to concentrate. We all have some ability to concentrate, but it's not really that good. So it's kind of like working out for that. We need to exercise that, develop that quality. So we can take our breath or a mantra or an image, anything, and just learn to keep our mind on the object. Concentration meditation. The next type of other type of meditation is referred to as analytic, where we take a topic, like in this class we'll do some analytic meditations on karma, the law of cause and effect, and we think about it in a very concentrated, still, deep way, using the concentration that we've developed to analyze the topic, argue with ourselves. And some people, when they start doing analytic meditation, it just seems like thinking. And it is to some degree, but it's thinking in a different way than our just normal, discursive, jumping around object to object sort of thinking. It's thinking on a particular subject. So the perfect meditation really combines both aspects, the concentration side and the analytic side. For those of us who are new to meditation, it's generally best to start off with some concentration meditation. That's a quality most of us could do with developing a little bit more of. I know I certainly could. So we're going to start tonight. with a simple concentration meditation. So the first thing is always to check your posture. There is nothing spiritual or holy about the posture. The point of the posture is to get your body very stable so that you don't have to pay attention, so that you're not distracted by it during the meditation. So it's fine to sit in a chair if that's more comfortable for you. You can sit on a chair on the floor. Whichever one you're choosing, you should sit a little bit to the front. If you're on a cushion, don't plop yourself in the back or the middle, really towards the front third, so you're tipped a little bit forward. If you're sitting in a chair or one of the pews, don't lean back, but sit forward a little bit so that your back is straight. Starting from the top, I think most people are familiar with this, but it's always good to run it down. Well, actually, I'm going to start with the back. The back is straight. Not rigid, but definitely a little straighter than we normally hold it. Okay, we kind of line our spinal column up nice and straight. Our hip, excuse me. Our head is straight on our shoulders, not tilted to one side or to the other. Maybe just a couple degrees in front of the vertical. Our eyes are either just lightly closed, or it's said even preferable, but you don't have to worry about this, just slightly open. So a little bit of light comes in, striking the back of the eyeballs, the retina, so that we don't fall asleep. Our mouth is lightly closed, not clenched. It's said that the best position for the tongue is on the gum above the upper teeth, on the back of that gum there. Our shoulders are down and a little bit open. So our chest is a little bit open, not hunched forward, but a little bit open. Our arms are away from our torso slightly. Hands, we can either put them on their knees, or more traditionally, we put the right hand on left with the thumbs touching, slightly below the level of the navel. And then the position of the legs is usually the most problematic part of the posture. If you're on a cushion, you can just cross your legs. You can put your right leg in front of your left. You can do a half lotus position, or you can do a full lotus position. The point is not to torture yourself or make yourself uncomfortable, but to find a stable position. If you're sitting in a chair, it's good to have your feet on the floor, and it's fine to put a cushion under your feet if you need that. So take a moment and just scan the posture, starting with your head and moving downwards. Identify any sources of stress or tension and see if you can relax those, getting them to wiggle out, so that once we start the actual meditation, you won't be paying attention to your body. And we'll begin the meditation with one version of what is described as the 9-round breathing, a somewhat exaggerated, definite form of breathing that helps to calm the mind and the body. So we take our right index finger, close our left nostril, and we're going to take 3 deep breaths in and out through the right nostril. And as we breathe, we want the stomach to expand on the in-breath, not pull in towards our spine, but expand so our diaphragm is moved down and our lungs completely fill. And then as we exhale, the stomach comes back in towards the spinal column. 3 breaths on the right side. Then we move the finger to the right side and do the same three breaths through the left nostril. And then three breaths in and out through both nostrils. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And traditionally we start our meditation by setting our motivation, really identifying to ourselves our reason for doing this. And whatever motivation has brought us to Kadampa Center tonight, when there are so many other things we could have done, is a good and just motivation. If we just came out of curiosity, that's fine. If we're just interested in a little peace of mind, that's great. In the Tibetan tradition, it's said that the greatest motivation, the most beneficial, is to think that everything I do, even something as simple as coming to Kadampa Center and sitting on a cushion for a few minutes, is done with the wish that it will make me of greater benefit to all living beings, to myself and to everyone else, my family, my friends, my co-workers, and ultimately everyone. Seems quite grandiose, even ridiculous, but that's what's referred to as the bodhisattva motivation, the great mind motivation. So just for a moment, as much as possible, try to generate that motivation, that I am doing this simple meditation to change my mind in a way so that I can be of greater benefit to others. I can be kinder, more peaceful, more loving, more generous. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation, a simple meditation of the concentration type. Our mind concentrates on the breath, the physical, tactile sensation of breath moving in and out through the nostrils. We place our mind, our awareness, directly on that. We're not counting the breaths. We're not thinking about the breaths. We're not visualizing ourselves breathing. We're just concentrating on the tactile sensation of breath moving in and out through the nostrils. And every time we notice our concentration has left the chosen object, we gently bring it back. Over and over and over again. And that is how we develop concentration. How we become familiar with our mind's ability to concentrate. Mind on the breath. That's all. Every time a distraction comes up, a sound, a memory, spot we need to scratch, we just set that aside and come back to the breath. Over and over and over again. And just as we began our meditation by setting our motivation, we end it by doing a dedication. We acknowledge that we've done something a little out of the ordinary. We've developed the quality of concentration in our mind. Our mind is just so infinitesimally slightly different than it was before we did this meditation. We acknowledge that. We mentally give ourselves a pat on the back and express the wish to ourselves that that positive imprint not be lost, but may it ripen in the future in a way that benefits all living beings. Any questions or comments about that meditation? Okay. It's a very simple one, but not easy. And as I said, it's just becoming familiar with our mind and its ability or inability to concentrate. I think when we first start doing it, we become very familiar with how distracted our mind is. It becomes very aware to us immediately. But that's a good thing. And with time, we actually do, it's very easy to see if we do a meditation like that regularly, it's quite easy to see progress. Our ability to stay on the chosen object develops pretty rapidly, actually. And then you hear these stories about these great meditators who can, one of the initial steps is to keep your mind on the chosen object for 9 minutes. Without it ever wandering for even a fraction of a second, which is an incredible achievement. And then it goes on to hours and then longer and longer. But, you know, we'll just work with a few minutes right now. We use the breath because it's a very neutral object. It's always present. Just concentrating on the breath is not enough to become enlightened, to become a Buddha. Okay, you can't breathe your way to meditation. You have to go above and beyond that. But we do have to develop that ability to concentrate. So that's why we always start with concentration meditation. Even when we're doing the analytic meditations later in the class, we'll always start with a few minutes of concentration to settle the mind and get it focused, because most of us are living such busy lives, we come in here with a lot of stuff going on. The point is not to space out, not to fall asleep, but actually develop a slightly more alert than usual quality of mind while we're doing our concentration. We're kind of moving up to another level. So that'll be a meditation I'm going to ask you to work on during the coming week. Before we get into the subject for this course, which is karma, I want to go back and just touch on the two previous modules. This is where those of you who've taken them will be contributing to the discussion this evening. The first module, which I taught at the end of last year, was called Mind, and its potential. And that, to me, is always the first module in the Discovering Buddhism series. I think it's one of the most important. It's something to always keep in. It's always important to keep mind in your mind. Buddhism is about working with your mind. Nothing more than that. That's why a lot of people don't even think it's a religion. They think it's more a type of psychology or cognitive therapy or something like that. Buddhism is working about with your mind. And when you come to Kadampa Center and you see all this stuff around here, and you see people ringing bells and chanting mantras and doing prostrations, if it freaks you out or you say, that's really weird, just remind yourself, even all of that, all these images here are to work with our mind. Buddhism is a non-theistic philosophy or religion. There is no external God who saves us or makes us enlightened. We have to do the work on our own, and all we have to do, our only help, the only thing we have to work with, excuse me, the only thing we have to work with is our mind. And that's what the historical Buddha did 2,500 years ago. He sat under the Bodhi tree, worked with his mind, and completely developed his mind to the point of becoming a Buddha, an enlightened being. And he said that's a possibility for all the rest of us. And he spent the rest of his life teaching. He was not a god. He was just someone who had developed his own mind to a certain degree that he felt he could share it with others. So, the potential for our mind is to become enlightened, okay, to become a Buddha. Each of us can become a Buddha, an enlightened being, not a god, but someone who has completely developed his own qualities of compassion and wisdom within his mind stream. Compassion is, anybody know the definition of compassion?
The wish that others not suffer.
Yeah, the wish that others be free from suffering. Excuse me. And wisdom is? That technically it's the realization of emptiness. In a more general term, means seeing reality, okay? Giving up all your delusions. So we have to develop our compassionate side and our wisdom side. That is the path to become enlightened. Those are the qualities that we have to develop in our mind. We have to get rid of all this anger and irritation and impatience and jealousy and resentment and just fill that up with compassion and wisdom, and then we're a Buddha. As I always say this, to be a Buddha, you have to be smart and you have to be nice, okay? You can't just be smart and you can't just be nice. You have to be smart and nice at the same time, okay? So it's all going in our mind. That's where the action is in Buddhism, in our mind. So what in the first module, for people who took that, we talked about the mind, and I used the term mind, consciousness, awareness, kind of interchangeably. What are the characteristics of mind? Anybody want to remember those? Yeah, what's the first one?
Non-physical.
It's non-physical, okay? We're talking about that non-physical aspect of our being, okay? It's not the brain, it's related to the brain, but it's completely non-physical, okay? I'm not going to teach the whole course over again, but I just want to touch on these points. Because I find this especially important when we're talking about karma, and I'll get into that a little bit tonight. Okay, the mind is non-physical. Okay, what's the next characteristic?
Without beginning.
Yeah, okay. It's without beginning and without end. No beginning. No end. My mind, my consciousness, this non-physical aspect of my being, goes back into the past without any beginning. It was not created at any point in time. It is completely without beginning. And it goes forward in the future and never comes to an end. There's no beginning and no end to our consciousness. We tend to think that our mind or our consciousness is limited to this body. The Buddhist point of view is that the body and mind come together temporarily, but that the consciousness continues on after the physical body decays. Okay, so consciousness is without beginning, without end. Third one? Yeah, it's in the nature, it's clear, okay? Or we could say it's empty. Or it has no fixed qualities. And that probably sounds like a lot of gobbledygook. So this is where analogies come into, are very useful. Our mind is like empty space in which the stars and the moons and planets appear. It's like a blue sky in which clouds pass through. But the mind has no fixed qualities of its own. We may think I am an angry person. And the Buddha would say, no, your mind is not fixed, permanently angry. You may have angry thoughts that arise in that emptiness that is your mind, but they're just temporary. The mind that is without beginning, without end, is like empty space, like clear light. And it's actually that that gives us the potential to become enlightened. The Buddha said all you have to do is get rid of the negative thoughts, the ones that cause suffering, and replace them with thoughts that cause happiness, which he said are wisdom and compassion. And you can do that because the mind is not fixed. It is totally empty, totally clear space. And you can fill it up with whatever you choose to. Certainly, and that's where karma comes in. Again, we'll talk about this more. Certainly, we don't feel like we have very much choice about what's in our mind right now. Mostly, we feel like we're the victim of circumstances and our parents and our economic situation and George Bush is really making me angry and or used to and all this stuff. The Buddha says, actually, at some level, you're responsible for all of that. You've chosen at some level. You may not have known it to put all that in your mind. Okay? Okay, and the fourth, what's the fourth point about the mind that we talked to in that class?
Function.
Yeah, it is. Its function is to know. And I'm going to use some other, to be aware of. To perceive. P-E-R-I before E, except after C. Perceive. The mind is aware of, okay? In that meditation, the point was to stay with our mind being aware of the breath. The mind perceives the breath. And at some level, the Buddha says, your mind is what it perceives, okay? It takes on the characteristics of whatever it's aware of. If we're having lots and lots of angry thoughts, for that time, our mind is angry. If we have lots of loving thoughts, we have a loving mind, okay? So we just have to fill that empty space up with the kind of thoughts that we want to have, okay? So that's the first course in a nutshell, just to give you a little bit of background. But the point is Buddhism is working with your mind. If you can't get anything else out of it, that's that. Okay, module number one is done. Module number two is presenting the path. Oh, did y'all do meditation? Okay. Okay, and who led that? Okay, great. So you did meditation, which is becoming familiar with. And meditation is in all of the modules, so I don't think I'm going to say anything about that. And then the next one was presenting the path, and Don taught that, and that one just finished up. Presenting the path. Okay, since I wasn't in that class, someone needs to summarize that one for me. What did y'all talk about in that? Okay, Lam Rim. I hear that word. That sounds very strange and foreign. What does Lam Rim mean? Graduated path. Okay, great. And who, where did we get the Lam Rim from? Yes. Okay. Lama Atisha, let's see, where is he? He is, yeah, this is he, here, yeah, Lama Atisha, when did he live? No, he lived earlier than that, didn't he? Didn't he live in the 500s, 600s? I think, yeah, I'm not very good at Tibetan history. Anyway, the Buddha taught around 2,500 years ago, tremendous number of teachings, hundreds and hundreds of teachings. Some that were recorded during his lifetime, most were written down after his lifetime. And he taught at all levels, very complicated, very simple, and he didn't feel like it was important to teach in any kind of organized or chronological order. So Lama Atisha, who was a great Indian scholar who took Buddhism to Tibet, organize the teachings into a structure that's called the Lamrim, okay? The graduated path to enlightenment, okay? And the root text is a light on the path, which is what Lama Zopa Rinpoche is teaching at the retreats he does every couple of years in the mountains of North Carolina. Translates as the graduated path. It's a structure in which all the teachings of the Buddha have been organized and placed in order so that if you follow this graduated path, not gradual, but for most of it's a very gradual path, it leads you from our present state of unhappiness to the state of being a Buddha. The Lamrim, and it's a general structure. Lama Atisha set it up, and many, many Tibetan masters have written Lamrim texts since then. And it's kind of what all the teachings here at Kadampa Center are based on. And the book I mentioned, Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, is a classic Lamrim text. It takes the teachings of the Buddha and places them into this structure called the Lamrim. So who can, just briefly, who can describe the structure of the Lamrim to me? Anyone want to take a stab at it? Okay. Yeah, I don't want to get too detailed. Okay, it's divided into what are called three scopes, the smaller scope, the middle scope, the greater scope. The teachings are placed in order, but in general, the first half, the first two scopes, are about developing wisdom, about starting to see reality. And those teachings lead to personal liberation, freedom from suffering, okay? The teachings in the greater scope, the last third, are about developing compassion. And that leads to the development of compassion, and the combination of the two, wisdom and compassion, leads to Buddhahood. And you don't have to this is just one structure. There is no reason as an individual practitioner that you have to follow things in that order. It's just this is a logical order. Some people jump right in with the compassion teachings. You don't have to master the ones on wisdom before you move to the ones on compassion. You can jump all around, and it's actually good to be working on all of them. But ultimately, you need the combination of the two. So, if we're starting with the wisdom teachings, what are some of the subjects we talk about there? What do we talk about in the first scope? Just give me a couple of them. Yeah. Death. Yes, that's always a big one. We talk about death. We talk about suffering. We talk about karma, okay? There are others, but these are the main ones that we talk about. These are teachings that are about seeing reality. The reality of death. The reality of suffering. The reality of karma. Those are the three big topics. There's others in there. And then when we get to the greater scope, it's all about patience and compassion and all the good stuff. So people hear all this and they say, oh, Buddhism is such a gloomy religion. You know, it's all about death and suffering and dying. And if you stop there, you'd think that. But then you have to get on to patience and generosity and ethics and all of that good stuff. So the subject of this course is karma, which is one of the early teachings in the Lamrim. It's one of the teachings to develop wisdom, to understand reality, so that we can free ourselves from suffering. Okay? That alone is not Buddhahood. We have to develop the compassion teachings also, the wish that others be free of suffering. If we completely master the wisdom teachings, we achieve what's called nirvana, which is not the same as Buddhahood. It's personal freedom from suffering. Buddhahood adds the compassion to it. Okay? So that just gives you a little idea of where this teaching goes in the big plan. Any questions or comments? Okay. Okay. We might end a little bit early because I've got this cold that's kind of bothering me, but we'll see how things go. Okay. So, subject for 6 weeks is karma. What's the translation of the word karma?
Action.
Yes, very good. That's one of the most important points in this course. Action. That's the actual translation. What are some other words we might use in association with karma besides action?
Cause and effect.
Okay. What else might people think of? Anything else come to mind? What other words you
think of, which I don't think is the right way to think of it.
Mm-hmm.
Goes around, comes around.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Goes around, comes around. What else do people think of? It doesn't have to be accurate. Yeah, what comes to mind when you think of karma?
Reap what you sow.
Reap what you sow. Uh-huh. Okay. What do you mean by predisposed? I think I know where you're going, but I just want to hear what you're thinking.
The moment is prejudice.
Uh-huh. Predestination?
Yeah.
I mean, we can put that down here. Any good Presbyterians here? Predestination?
Luck?
Yeah. Okay. We'll put down luck. What else?
Habit?
Yeah, that's a good one. Okay.
I think it's quantum projections.
Quantum projections. That's a new one. You want to explain for us?
Pushing yourself forward with everything you do.
Okay.
Pushing yourself in a different direction.
Anything else?
Free will versus destiny.
Yeah, free will. Okay, free will. Okay. One I always think of as the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. I mean, the word karma is used a lot in pop culture, and we're going to try and discuss it from a strictly Buddhist point of view. But that's all what we think of when we think about karma. So I'm going to erase everything but action. This does not... Is there some sort of spray or something to use on here? It's not erasing very well. Yeah, exactly. It's karmic inference. Let's erase my negative karma. That's good. Action. By action, the Buddha meant... Okay, wait a minute. The Buddha did not invent karma. This is not some theory he came up with. This was his description of what he saw out there. He said, and from the Buddhist point of view, karma is the basic law of reality. It's like the Buddhist version of gravity. It's not made up. It's not good or bad. It's just the way things are. And I've even heard people go as far as to say that karma is the closest thing you'll find in Buddhism to a god. Because it's karma that's making the world go around. Everything is a result of karma. But it's not the Buddha's description or invention. It's not something he thought of saying, hey, that's a neat idea. This is what he saw when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree. And he is just telling us what he saw. And we talk about it in all sorts of different ways, but the great teachers like the Dalai Lama say that karma is the most profound and most difficult subject to understand in all of Buddhism. And, you know, when you get into things like emptiness and all that, that seems so difficult. I mean, there's something harder than this by what they mean, seeing the play of karma in every aspect of our experience. And it said if you're a great meditator, you can see karma directly. In this class, we're just going to be talking about it and intellectualizing about it and discussing and theorizing, but saying that these great meditators actually see how karma is working. They look at this cushion and they see directly all the karma that went into the existence of this cushion that has made this cushion exist here at Kadampa Center. Not my experience, but that's what they say. Okay, so we're talking about actions. By this we mean actions of body, speech, and mind, what are often referred to as the three doorways. And the Buddha say an action is anything we do with our body, anything we say, anything we think is an action. And the Buddha said every single action of these three doorways makes an imprint on our mind, influences our mind, affects our mind in a way that we will experience in the future. Even the most trivial thought of irritation is doing something to our mind that affects our future experience, that helps determine our future experience. And this is why I wanted to touch on mind and its potential. I think it's really important to think about karma as a psychological process. We tend to think of, if we're new to the subject, we think about it very mechanistically. I killed you in this life, so I will be reborn in the next life and you'll kill me. And I think that's a very mistaken and incorrect way to think of karma. Karma is about the imprints that we put on our mind by our actions of body, our actions of speech, our actions of mind that determine what we will experience in the future. It's completely neutral, the law of karma, in the same way law of gravity is neutral. It's just what is. I drop this cushion, it falls. I do an action, it makes an imprint on my mind stream. So the Buddhist point of view is that we need to stop putting imprints on our mind stream that will cause us to be unhappy in the future and start putting imprints on it that will make us happy in the future. It's like our mind is, I've heard it compared to like a magnetic tape with imprints that are being put on, or some impressions or whatever you put on magnetic tape, patterns. But onto this continuum that's without beginning, without end, everything we do is putting an imprint on it that we will experience the results of in the future. It's kind of assumed that they're past lives and future lives. That's a whole other course, and I don't think you have to accept that to get some value from the teachings of karma. Okay? You know, I think the idea of past and future lives, i.e. the consciousness comes together with different bodies, makes sense. I certainly can't say I absolutely believe it. I can't prove it, but it does seem logical. But even if we reject that, I think the idea of karma has a lot of value just in this lifetime. Okay? Any questions or comments? Okay. So karma is this impersonal force or law that runs the universe. Let me just, there's just one thing I wanted to check. Go to my crib sheet here. Okay. The mechanics of it. What does that mean? What about the mechanics of it?
If you're talking about gravity, of course, you can, vectors and everything else, you can completely predict what gravity is going to do based on what physical element you're talking about.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about karma, you've got all of these different actors.
Yeah.
You have psychological influences, obviously, which, I mean, I guess to a physicist would boil down to a bunch of electrons firing off, and neural synapse and everything else. But supposedly there is a, if there is a mechanic to it, then there is a predictable outcome for everything that you do. Otherwise, it would be random and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you're saying there got to be some rules, right? That's the next subject. There are four rules of karma. He's a plant, I tell you. But it, as people know when they study Tibetan Buddhism, everything is enumerated. There are always four of this and 27 of that and 83,000 of these, okay? But tonight, this is a very simple one. We're not going to get through these tonight, but I just want to introduce them to you, and we'll talk about them more next week because I wanted to do another meditation. Four rules of karma. These are the big rules, and then there's some more others we'll get into. One, karma is definite. Okay, what does that mean? Virtuous actions, loaded word there, always lead to happiness. Non-virtuous actions always lead to suffering. A lot of loaded words in there. I'll come back to that, but definite in that a virtuous action cannot lead to unhappiness in the future, okay? A non-virtuous action cannot cause happiness. That's what they mean by definite. The results are definite. Second law of karma. Anybody know what the second one is? Yeah, it expands over time. Like a seed that grows into a tree. A karmic seed that seems quite small, just that one harsh word to someone that you love very much, if allowed to stay on the continuum in the future, can ripen in a huge argument, can ripen in a divorce, you know, can ripen in a murder, who knows. Karmic seeds expand over time. In the same way, don't clutch your chest. So you always got to remember that when we talk about karma, we always think about bad stuff, negativity. We've got to think about the good stuff, too. You know, just a tiny kind word or a smile to somebody will also expand in the same way. Okay? Karma expands over time. Anybody know what the third one is? That's the fourth one. Okay, the third one's a little bit trickier, but in some ways it's almost the most important one. And there are lots of ways it's phrased, but I'm going to say...
You can experience somebody else's karma.
No, yeah. That's close. Were you going to say, Chris?
Results similar to the cause?
Yeah, I'm going to say no result without the cause. That's saying, if I want to be happy, the only way I can become happy is to create the causes for it. There is no randomness. There is no luck. Everything I want to experience in the future, I have to create the causes for. I'm not just going to win the lottery. If I want to win the lottery, I've got to create the causes to win the lottery. Okay. Anything I want to experience in the future, love, compassion, happiness, joy, I have to create the causes for. It just won't happen. And then the flip side of that is everything I am experiencing, I have created the causes for at some point in the past. Everything in my experience, all the good stuff, all the bad stuff, all the neutral stuff, down to, you know, somebody pulling out in front of me in the intersection, in some way, and again, we'll talk about this more, I have created the causes for that. I'm not to blame. I'm not guilty. This gets really loaded. But I am responsible. I am responsible for everything the most minuscule to the most devastating to the most wonderful aspects of my experience. I have created the cause in the past, and I will create the cause for everything I experience in the future. There's absolutely no randomness in the Buddhist world. There's no luck. There's no God who's doing this to us. It is all what we have created. Okay? That's a heavy one. Yeah, we'll get into emptiness later in this course. Emptiness and karma really flip sides of each other in some ways. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the fourth one is... Somebody said it earlier.
It doesn't go away.
Yeah, it's the way they traditionally say karma is not lost. You can't kick it under the carpet or pretend it didn't happen or think that it's going to just disappear of old age. It doesn't happen. Karma, every karmic seed we create lasts and will be experienced. There are two exceptions to this, though. One's very good news, one's very bad news. What can you do with bad karma?
Purify.
We can purify negative karma. Karma that would cause suffering. We can purify it, which means we can lessen its imprint on our mind stream. And when we have a direct understanding of emptiness, we can completely remove negative karma from our mind stream. We can't do that until we understand emptiness. And then what's the bad news? What can we do to good karma? How can we get rid of good karma?
Anger
destroys good karma. Bummer. It burns it up. So that's a big reason not to get angry. So next week we'll go into each one of these in more detail. Karma is definite in that virtuous actions. Virtue means actions motivated by compassion. Always lead to happiness. Non-virtuous actions always lead to suffering. Doesn't seem real obvious. Sometimes we do something great and people just spit in our face, but that's making false karmic assumptions. Karma expands over time. We do not experience any result that we have not created the cause for. Everything we experience now, we created the cause for in the past. Everything we will experience in the future, we're creating the cause for. And then karma is not lost, with two exceptions.
On the first rule?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I guess the old saying is, for no good tree bears bad fruit, and no bad tree can bear good fruit.
Uh-huh.
So you are implying at the same time that it's impossible for a virtuous action to result in suffering, and for a non-virtuous action to result in happiness.
Yeah, according to the Buddha. Mm-hmm.
That's, so you're implying both the positive and the negative.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. The Buddha, yeah, it's an absolute, yeah, it's definite. Okay? So next week we'll go into each one of those in more detail, but that just gives you an outline of where we're going next week. And so I wanted to do another meditation to close. We'll start with some more concentration on the breath. And then we'll do a little bit of what's called review meditation, where I'm just going to give you each one of these four laws of karma. And I want you to just kind of concentrate on it and fix it in your mind stream. Not necessarily try to understand it, but just get familiar with the terms. So next week we'll be ready to go. Okay, begin by scanning your posture, starting with your head and your back and moving downwards, finding a posture that you find stable. do the 9-round breathing, and you can just do that on your own. And now allow your breathing to return to its normal pattern and set your motivation for doing the meditation. And having set your motivation, we now begin the actual meditation, concentrating on our breath. We place our awareness, our consciousness, the non-physical aspect of our being, on the physical sensation, the tactile sensation of breath moving in and out through the nostrils. Every time the awareness wanders, we gently lead it back. We don't get rough or angry, just bring it back over and over, just developing the mental habit of concentration. We're becoming familiar with the act of concentration. And now that our mind is a little bit more concentrated, a little bit more focused, a little bit more alert, we're just going to do a quick review of the four laws of karma. Point is not really to try and analyze them right now. Just become familiar with them. It's almost like you're studying for a test. Just get the words in your mind. The analysis and the discussion will follow. The first law is that karma is definite. Virtuous actions always lead to happiness. Non-virtuous actions always lead to suffering. No ifs, ands, or buts. Karma is definite. Second law is that karma expands over time. Small karmic seeds grow. Both virtuous and non-virtuous expand over time. The third law is that we do not experience any result without having created the cause. No result without a cause. Everything we experience now, we have created the causes for in the past. Everything we wish to experience in the future, we must create the causes for now. No luck, no randomness. We don't experience anything without having caused it. And the fourth law is that karma is not lost. Every karmic seed will be experienced at some point in the future. We can purify negative karma, and we can destroy good karma, but no karmic seed is lost. Now just take a moment and run over the four laws in your mind to yourself. And if you need to, you can refer to the board. But again, just get the words fixed in your mind. Become familiar with them. And you can end your meditation by doing a dedication. Okay. See, this is the homework, if you could pass those out. And then if you're doing the class for credit, these are the completion sheets, so not everybody needs those. Maybe people would hold their hands up. If you're doing the class for credit, get a completion sheet. Take-home messages tonight. Karma is a psychological process. It occurs in the non-physical mind, and karma means action, okay? Next week, we'll go through the four laws of karma in greater detail. Question? Are you holding up? Okay. That's it. Okay. See you next week. Mm-hmm. And there is a discussion group out at the library table, right, Sandy?
Yes.
Okay.
And you are more than welcome to stay with us.
I'm going, it's cold. I'm going home, yeah.
That's fine.
Thank you, though, yeah.
What'd you do to cause
that? That's a good question, you know. I'm not a great meditator, so I can't see my past karma.